Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Preparing for the Post-Course Era conference call. At this time, all participant lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your moderator, Mr. Scott Jessick. Please go ahead.
Hello, I'm Scott Jessick, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on preparing for the post-course era. Higher education beyond courses may seem scary to some, but it's very much here, even as courses have not disappeared. Study after study links student success and engagement not just to classroom learning, but to a range of out-of-the-classroom experiences. Randy Bass, director of the Visible Knowledge Project and a professor at Georgetown University, is a national expert on the implications of these shifts, and he'll be our guide today. Randy will first lead us through a PowerPoint you all should have received. If any of you didn't receive it, please email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll get it to you right away. Shortly before the end of his presentation, we'll let you know how to ask questions, and then we'll have a Q&A. Randy, welcome.
Thank you, Scott, and thanks to all of you who've taken the time to come and listen today. I appreciate that. I know there's a wide range of types of institutions represented out there and diverse roles of folks in those schools, and I hope that my remarks feel relevant to that whole range. So what I want to talk about today is what I've recently come to call the post-course era. Let me just clarify by what I mean by the post-course era, because it might seem rather counterintuitive to everyday reality. By post-course era, I mean not that courses will cease to exist or even that they can't continue to be the way that we organize the curriculum. Obviously, I don't see that changing anytime soon. But I do believe that we're at the very beginning of an important shift away from thinking of the course as a bounded experience that's relatively separate unto itself. I also think that that we're in a shift at a point where we have to at least seriously question the assumption that courses and the formal curriculum are the center of the undergraduate experience. And obviously, we fund our institutions as if courses were the center of education, and we hire as if that were the case. But I think it's time for us to ask questions about that assumption, and I think in many ways, financial circumstances everywhere are going to force us increasingly to do so. It also seems to me that this is in many ways the inevitable consequence of, you know, what we call the learning paradigm. Barr and Tagg wrote their famous article in 1995 about the shift from teaching to learning, from an instructional paradigm to a learning paradigm, many of you, of course, familiar with. And part of that shift was thinking that the course in a learning paradigm increasingly only has meaning as part of a much larger conception of learning. So to follow out the logic of the learning paradigm is to understand courses less as isolated units and more as parts of wholes. And in the process of taking that seriously, that is, that a course is really part of some larger, more integrated whole, it may be that the course is never quite the same if we really take that seriously. So ultimately, this shift involves more than just asking faculty to redesign their courses differently. It really implies a whole shift in what we think of as the boundaries of the course, the boundaries of the formal curriculum, who we think of as instructors, how we assess learning, and how we recognize and reward teaching. So all those things, to me, are all bound up in what I think of as the post-course era. So let me talk a little bit about what kind of galvanized this thought for me and then look at some research. If you look at slide two, this especially hit me when I was doing a series of focus groups on campus, part of a larger curriculum initiative we had, and I decided to sit down and do some focus groups with students, first years, seniors, including young alumni. And in one of the focus groups with first-year students, one of the students was talking about a typical course that he had that where he was felt like he wasn't being asked to engage with the material and he wasn't asked to do anything but sit passively and then spit the information back. And I asked him if that bothered him, and he said, well, you know, it was taught as a gen ed course, and I took it as a gen ed course. Now, hopefully this is something we can all both relate to and all collectively cringe at. And what was really striking was he really said it without the least bit of sarcasm, irony, or disappointment. He said it as if this were merely a descriptive category of a particular kind of intentional experience that institutions offer. It was really particularly disturbing, I think, because he was really responding, claiming that he was responding as a student to the way that he perceived that the course was being offered to him by the teacher. So what I think is interesting about this kind of, but this has really become kind of a mantra for me, this just taught as a gen ed course, is that as I increasingly listen to students talk about their relative modest satisfaction or dissatisfaction with their courses, I'd ask late in the focus group, well, so are you happy here? And to a person, they would say they loved it. They were all extremely happy. And I was trying to put these two things together, and one student, again, a first-year student, said, well, you know, there's a difference between a Georgetown degree and a Georgetown education, by which she meant that her courses were not the place where her education was, and that her real learning wasn't really happening in the classroom. It was happening outside at some boundary between the social and the intellectual. So if you look at slide 4, this really jibes with, the findings that even Richard Light found and talked about in his 2002 book, Making the Most Out of College, Students Speak Their Minds, that most graduates have far clearer memories of their singing or writing or volunteer tutoring than the details of any particular class they took. And if you look at slide 5, he goes on to say that that leads to a simple but enormously powerful finding that students who make connections between what goes on inside and outside the classroom report a more satisfying college experience. So this is all relatively intuitive. I think many of us probably remember that from our own experience and probably what we observe on our campuses. And I think we all know at any type of school that there are students who, feel that a lot of the courses they take are largely obligatory and from which they're disconnected. If any of you have seen the really excellent video made by students at Chabot College, Chabot is a community college in Northern California, and the students there made a wonderful video called Reading Between the Lives about community college students' relationship to assigned reading and coursework. You see much of the same disaffection in that video with coursework and the same yearning for relevance. So all of this is, very negative, it probably seems, but it seems to me that what's very important then is to link this to kind of complementary data that's especially come out of NESE, the National Survey on Student Engagement. So if you look at slide 6 now, this is really the important twist and contextualization on, what otherwise might seem kind of shoulder shrugging data that, of course, not all students get into all courses, and that's just the way college is. But the NESE data has, defined for us a list that, is probably familiar to a lot of you around what they call high impact practices. And these are the things that they've identified, particularly as high impact activities or high impact practices at institutions. So, first-year seminars and experiences, learning communities, writing intensive courses, collaborative assignments. Those are somewhat course-based experiences. And then another list, undergraduate research, study abroad, global learning, internships, capstone projects, et cetera. So this is what they call high-impact experiences, and I'm sure there's some discourse around that on most of your campuses. If you look at slide 7, then, they're called high-impact practices because they have found through the NESE data that they correlate, significantly with the outcomes that are associated with deep learning. So that these are the practices that students self-identify most allow them to, attend to underlying meaning, slide 7 here, integrate and synthesize, discern patterns, apply knowledge, garner issues from multiple perspectives, and most importantly, that they're making gains both in skills and knowledge, practical competence, which is, I think, very important, and personal and social development. So what makes them high-impact practices is that they imply the ability to integrate your learning with experience, that they are able to help people develop a kind of embodied learning, that it's not merely cognitive, it's emotional, it's personal, it's social. If you look at slide 8, I think one of the things that's really significant then about this growing discourse then around high-impact practices, which I recently attended the National Conference of the American Association of Colleges and Universities, where there's a lot of high-impact practice talk going on. I went back through the program in preparation for this, looked at all of the panels that talked about high-impact practices, and I pulled one as just typical here, where they talk about this panel addresses, you know, ways that the transformative impact of study abroad, so that's one of these high-impact practices, can be further enhanced and extended to the campus learning community. Through presentations, case studies, and audience discussion, this panel will address how the integration of study abroad with high-impact integrative learning activities, such as undergraduate research, senior capstones, or service learning, can be both transformative for both students and institutions. So this is very typical, it seems to me, of the way that we tend to talk about high-impact practices, which is usually either by themselves as add-ons or in relationship to other high-impact practices. So if you look at slide number 9, and you're looking at this list of these practices, and you're looking at these outcomes that are associated with deep learning, that this is really the center of a lot of the discourse at the edge of higher education right now. And if you're at a national meeting like the AACNU, it's in the relationship between these two columns where a lot of conversation is going on, and quite possibly the same on your campuses. But this really, to me, raises the key question, and the key question about the post-course era, and that's my slide number 10, which is, if high-impact practices are largely in the extra curriculum or the co-curriculum, learning communities, internships, study abroad, undergraduate research, then where are the low-impact practices? They must be in the curriculum. You know, if we're identifying that high-impact activities are largely in these extra kinds of things that we offer, then the low-impact practices must be at the heart of what we offer. And that's the question that I think is worth thinking about. It's occurred to me increasingly over the last several years, and not just at my own institution, but I've visited 10 or 20 different institutions every year of all different kinds, and I find this is true everywhere, which is that all institutions espouse certain core values, but that when you ask where those core values are really being operationalized and realized, many of them often are pointed not toward core practices, but toward marginalized practices. So they're marginalized practices, things like service learning, that are marginalized either implicitly in the curriculum, or they're also marginalized in terms of the way that dollars get spent on them. But it seems to me that one of the presenting symptoms of the post-course era is the growing misalignment between our core values and our core practices. So looking now at slide 11, that's where we come to think about, are we then entering the post-course era? And of course, again, this is not to say that courses are not important or that there are not a lot of great courses on any campus, or at least many, many good ones and some great ones, or that we shouldn't be very actively engaged in making courses better and more enriched, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I do think that we're getting to a point where we have to see in many ways that the traditional, bounded, non-connected, isolated course is passing out of relevance for the way that we are currently imagining what it is we add of value to an undergraduate experience. I have at times joked that perhaps like Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense, the course is already dead, but it just doesn't know it. And that's a much easier joke to tell if you're in a room where you can tell if people are offended or not. So I'm going to pretend that you're not. So these are the questions then I think that are important to ask, and to ask, you know, are we entering a phase where we think of the course and thus the center of undergraduate curriculum entirely differently? If you look at slide 12, I think it's interesting to think about the electronic portfolio movement as a sign and symptom of the post-course era. And I'm sure on some of the campuses that are listening in, there's some kind of e-portfolio project going on, or e-portfolio initiative, or you're thinking about an e-portfolio initiative, if not a leader in it. And I think that e-portfolios are very much about moving beyond courses, that the rising interest and importance of e-portfolios is a sign that we have come to believe in that there's actually the best way to look at student achievement is not in any particular course, or not to merely have faith in the aggregation of a whole set of isolated experiences, but to give students a place, an integrative place, where they themselves make their own connections, where they themselves think in terms larger than courses, and where folks who are looking at the portfolios can also make judgments about a whole body of student work. If you think about a project like the AACNU's Value Project that has created a whole range of usable rubrics for looking at e-portfolios related to the essential learning outcomes of liberal education, you know, they're founded in this belief that the best way for us to understand student achievement across time is to look not at the course, but at a body of student work and a diverse collection of student work products knit together by reflections that the student, him or herself, has written, and then judged through rubrics that are tied to these large essential outcomes. But the whole premise in many ways of that is that courses are merely stepping stones to something larger, and that the unit of analysis is really beyond the course. But I think that what also is interesting about the electronic portfolio movement is that a whole lot of the discourse surrounding portfolios is not only positively about the aggregation of a student's work, but it's also very much being carried on in the name of, or often in the spirit of, you know, what can we do with electronic portfolios that allows us not to deal with faculty or not to deal with courses? How is it that we could actually institute portfolios that are insensible of faculty work in course design? The whole notion that courses and faculty could be much more integrated to the overall portfolio process is a really minor part of the entire portfolio movement. I understand that there are some, you know, ways to imagine portfolio-based courses, et cetera, but by and large, the discussion of e-portfolio projects on campus is really about institutions in one form or another connecting with students at the programmatic or institutional level, and that courses really only serve the purpose of being the occasions out of which students pluck their work to put in the portfolio. So I think that's an interesting site where these tensions are felt. So if you look at slide 13 then, I would say that really there are three ways to respond to, if not the post-course era, which I would see it as, at least to the now increasingly visible tensions between the formal curriculum and the co-curriculum. And these are, seems to me, three ways to respond. One is to make courses higher impact, and you make courses more like high impact practices. Second is to design better connections between courses and the high impact experiences that already exist outside the formal curriculum. And the third is to start rethinking the relationship between the curriculum and the co-curriculum. So I want to briefly address each of these, and I think they probably go sort of in order of horizons of change. So if you think about first the question of, you know, what would it mean to make courses higher impact? If you look now at slide 15, you know, there's obviously a range of ways that people are already taking up that on campuses, and I've been working with faculty development, especially around active learning and new technologies for 15 or 20 years. And of course, that's, you know, part of the way that we've tried to imagine innovation. A lot of people engaged in redesigning courses is inquiry-based or project-driven or problem-driven, which I think makes them closer to a higher impact experience, or redesigning courses, you know, for different kinds of depths and engagement, writing intensiveness, for example, as Nessie has found. And I think also increasingly, you know, ways of thinking of making, using, for example, social tools at scale, technological tools at scale. I think what's interesting about where we're at is that 20 years ago, you know, the excuse that, well, we can imagine what a high-impact course would look like in terms of everybody involved and not a passive experience, but you can't do that at scale. You can't do that with a really large class, with really large enrollment classes, and that maybe 20 years ago, that was a perfectly good excuse to talk about how you couldn't achieve some of this at scale. But in fact, that has changed very much now, and it's changed with the rise of so-called Web 2.0 tools and participatory tools, that in fact, not only is it possible to enact engaging participatory pedagogies at scale, but that the tools that we're trying now to bring into the classroom are tools that actually have originated at scale. And in some cases, they're tools that actually work better at scale. They're tools that come from large, massive communities of people who are engaged in a certain kind of intellectual work or semi-intellectual work that provide really powerful models on how to rethink large enrollment classes. So the ability to rethink what it means to think of a high-impact course in a large enrollment setting has changed significantly. If you look at slide 16, and we look at the participatory culture of the web as a model, I think it's really interesting to look at this list created by Henry Jenkins and his colleagues in a MacArthur Foundation report called Confronting the Challenges of Participatory Culture, in which they identify what they consider to be the features of participatory culture. And you see them there on slide 16, low barriers to entry, strong support for sharing one's contributions, informal mentorship between experienced and novice, members feel a sense of connection, sense of ownership, a sense that something is at stake. I think it's interesting to look at a list like that and ask how many courses could you describe as having those features? How many courses could you describe as having that kind of participatory culture that was fully integrated in whatever it was that made that discipline interesting or that material necessarily difficult? But this, to me, is one of the ways to imagine how to make courses higher impact, is to think about the ways in which people are increasingly learning in informal environments. And I would say that one of the great and really trenchant challenges of the next 5 to 10 years in terms of pedagogy is to ask the question, how do we make formal learning more like informal learning? And it won't look exactly the same, but what is it about informal learning that we can adapt? And it seems to me a list of those participatory features is one way to begin the conversation. And if you look at slide 17, you know, this would probably merit a longer conversation and that any of you could have in your groups, but, you know, well, what is the relationship then between the features of participatory culture that are described as being the features of informal learning environments on the web and what are perceived as the outcomes that make high-impact experiences high outcome or high-impact? What do we perceive to be the relationship? What are the resonances between those two lists? If you turn to slide 18, you know, this is also where I think I see the formal curriculum and why I think about the post-course era in the way that I do, that in a sense it's really being squeezed pressure for integration from both sides. So on the one hand, you have informal learning and a participatory culture of the web, this growing explosion within our culture of the ways that people learn informally outside of class. And that's a kind of other to the formal curriculum, often seen in the tension that people have about even having laptops in class. And on the other hand, you have these high-impact practices and the experiential curriculum and the co-curriculum and this add-on, plug-in part of the curriculum or of the undergraduate experience that's increasingly the place where we see the strongest outcomes. So if you, to me, thinking about the post-course era is looking at the formal curriculum, the thing that we have presumed is the center and core and dominant piece of an undergraduate education, and seeing these two forces pressing in on both sides. So that's a set of questions about strengthening courses as courses. I think then, and I'll speed a little bit through the latter two, you know, what does it mean to think about making better connections between courses and outside experiences? Skip over to slide 20. You know, of course, there's some of this going on your campus already, I presume, where people are trying to think about how do you connect courses, the curriculum to the co-curriculum. Community-based learning or service learning courses are probably, I think, one of the more successful and active places where that's going on. In some places, perhaps field work or internships or in certain kinds of professional degree programs where there's courses that are actually designed to give structure to fieldwork experiences. Some people are working more of a study abroad and how to make the study abroad experience where your students go abroad. And, of course, electronic portfolios, as I've talked about, you know, if you look at places like LaGuardia Community College or Clemson or Washington State or San Francisco State University, some of the places with really successful portfolio projects, that's where they're really trying to, you know, think about how do you at least put students in a position to make these connections. But if you look at slide 21, I'm really, and have for a long time, been interested in kind of stepping back and asking, in part, what is it that we would need to understand to be able to do more structurally with experiential learning? And I think that there's actually striking similarities between the struggle to understand better what happens when students learn experientially and what happens in the intermediate process of when students are trying to learn anything, including informal courses, if you're taking a very participatory approach. So the difference between slide 21, which I, my colleague and I, Heidi Elmendorf, have imagined as sort of the workflow of the instructional paradigm, the pre-learning paradigm, that experts did the thing they did, and we asked novices to do little mini versions of what experts did, and we just hoped that it all worked out. To look over to slide 22, which is what I think is starting to happen as we start to understand that the complexity of these intermediate thinking processes and that there's all kinds of learning processes going on, but that increasingly, whether it's through digital or non-digital means, you know, I think one of the salient questions is, you know, how do we better understand and capture and make useful for students what happens when they're struggling to know, what happens when they're struggling to problem solve, what happens in these intermediate spaces. And I think if we could have more conversations between the folks who are working with students in experiential contexts about their struggles to learn and develop and a more nuanced conversation about what happens in course contexts when students are learning and struggling in a participatory way, that we would find that there were much deeper connections to create between the curriculum and the co-curriculum beyond merely you know, kind of surface reflections. If you look at slide 23, it's a long-standing and interesting a graphic that John Seely Brown uses in a lot of his work, his iceberg of knowledge. Learning about is the explicit part of knowledge, the content. Learning to be is the tacit knowledge in action. Talking about how for too long we've taught above the waterline when, in fact, most of the knowledge is below the waterline. But he has a recent twist on this that I think is really interesting that he calls reversing the flow, which is that he says, for a long time, we've designed our curriculum to move from content to practice, that we basically shoved as much content to students for as long as they could stand it. And then if you stuck with a major long enough, you ended up moving from just content to actually practicing and understanding what it is like to actually engage in that practice. And what John Seely Brown says is that both, especially because of the changing nature of culture on the internet, and other things we're learning about how people learn, the shift that's really happening now is that the flow really needs to be from practice to content, that practice drives people to content. And what would it look like to design a curriculum that was not designed from the ground up to move from content to practice, but designed to move from practice to content? And to me, that question is the same question as what does it mean to move into a post-course era? What does it mean to rethink what we think of as a course? This very much jives, just have slide 24, jives with, you know, other phrases that I think really resonate that I won't elaborate on, but what in 10 years of studies of preparation for the professions, the Carnegie Foundation, Lee Shulman calls judgment in uncertainty, that the number one thing that happens when you prepare someone to be a professional is that it isn't so much that you prepare them to know certain content, it's you prepare them to make informed and responsible judgments in conditions of uncertainty, or what Bill Sullivan, in a kind of synthesis of that work, calls practical reason. Again, what does it look like if we imagine putting students in positions to exercise and be reflective about their judgments in conditions of uncertainty in any course or in the connection between courses and experiences? What would that look like if we imagined a curriculum to operate that way? So looking at slide 25, rethinking the relationship between the curriculum and the co-curriculum, I think this is a much more open question, and I think this is one that we're only beginning to have this discussion about. But it seems to me, as I ask on slide 26, that it's important for us to at least be asking, you know, can we any longer afford to act as if the formal curriculum were the center of the undergraduate experience, especially if that means underfunding and underdeveloping the kind of experiences we're increasingly understanding correlate with deep learning. And as many of us move into increasing circumstances of fiscal constraints, we're talking about shrinking or reducing or enlarging, making larger courses, you know, how could we perhaps enter this into the conversation? What would it look like, for example, to trade courses for experiences in a curriculum? I don't know of many places that have yet undertaken that. Worcester Polytechnic Institute did many years ago. Wagner College with the Wagner Plan, where they build in a freshman experience, you know, and traded that and made that a part of their gen ed. Some of your institutions might have similar kinds of trade-offs. But I think that trade-off between courses and experience, or rethinking the way that courses connect to each other and to experiences, both as a way to respond to high-impact learning opportunities and as a way to respond to financial constraints, is probably the best circumstances in which to have a conversation about constrained resources. So let me wind down here by looking at slide 27, which is comes from some work of a fellow named Tim Castell, who teaches at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. And Tim looks at successful open business models on the web, and he's really interested in the question of how do businesses or enterprises add value in a digital economy. He's particularly looked at journalism and music, and he's come up with three phenomenon that he thinks really capture what it is that industries can do, businesses can do to add value, and he calls it aggregate, they filter, and they connect. So just to use a simple example of Amazon.com, you know, Amazon aggregates large amounts of information together from all the publishers. That's one of the ways that it creates value. It has a number of ways to filter that information, including a search engine, which is a filter, and reviews and things like that. And then it makes connections, even if you just think of when you've selected a book and it says other people who have bought this book also enjoyed these two other books. So if you think of those three functions, aggregating, filtering, and connecting, that if we value that site, that we probably value all three of those activities. And if you look at iTunes and Politico, many other web businesses that are managing to make some money, it's because they figured out ways to do those three things successfully. So one of the things that Tim also thinks about, if you look at slide 28, is wondering, how does this work then with higher education? And he says, well, if you look historically, that higher education does three things. It has, for a long time, aggregated information, that it was the place where stuff was. People had slides of butterflies and art prints, and that it was the place that was aggregated as you went to university, because that's where the information was. Higher education institutions filter in a whole number of different ways. We filter what knowledge is worth knowing, filter scholarship through peer review, and in many ways we filter graduates by helping employers figure out who's employable. And then we also make connections between ideas and experiences and people. So this is how he sees how it works in higher education. So I've tried to take his musings in thinking about what then is implied in a shift that I call the post-course era in terms of how we add value. And if you just skip over to slide 30, this is then how I see, in part this playing out, that if in the course era, the instructional paradigm, the era in which we imagine that one of the functions of courses was to introduce students to large amounts of information, as well as ways of thinking, that the course era really was focused on the aggregation and the filtering part of that triad. But as we enter the post-course era, in an environment of seemingly infinite information and lots of ways to find information resources, where higher education has long lost its monopoly on information, then the shift is really toward the filtering and the connecting function. And again, I think whether it's building from the ground up or reimagining parts of a gen ed curriculum or a particular piece of a curriculum in a major, does it look differently to imagine how we go about on a campus in an integrative way the way that we imagine we're adding value is really primarily built around filtering and connecting and not around aggregating and filtering? What kinds of different choices would we make? How would we privilege certain kinds of activities? Who would we want to include in that conversation on a campus if we really valued connecting as much as we valued filtering and as much as we used to value, just sort of the aggregation of information?
Before you wrap up, I want to briefly interrupt here so our operator can explain how people can pose questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
Also, if you would like to have a question asked but you don't want to be identified or have your institution identified, you may email it to me at info@insidehighered.com, and I will read it without identifying you. Randy, back to you for the wrap-up.
Okay, thanks. So slide 31, how do we best match our resources with the experiences that add the most value? And I think that's what campuses have to grapple with. And at the moment, to me, the symptoms of the post-course era is that right now we have, in some ways, a mismatch between how we're spending our resources and the experiences that seem to add the most value. Can we continue to afford everything plus? That we'll just continue to do everything, not worrying about low impact, high impact, et cetera, and tag on all these extra things that we know are valuable and scrape together money to do them. How do we respond to this shifting ground between curricular and co-curricular learning? Slide 32, I just have, a few thoughts of, what are some of the conditions for taking this up, and I think there are other simpler practical things which hopefully will come up in the Q&A, but I think for the most part, our notion of learning has far outstripped our understanding of assessment. For all of the talk about assessment and the drive of accreditation agencies to get places to identify learning goals and other kinds of assessment, we actually haven't really advanced very far in thinking about how to assess students. We've only advanced in at least rhetorically valuing that we should be making assessment more transparent. So we especially need ways to learn more about how to assess students for learning that emerges in practice, whether participatory courses or experience. I think we have to have a conversation, a much more nuanced conversation about how we count faculty load. And this is obviously complicated in many ways by, places with large numbers of contingent and adjunct faculty. It's complicated in other kinds of settings as well. You know, what do we count as teaching? If we're moving to a post-course era, the notion of what teaching is has to be recognized for the complexity that's already assuming. And I think also for places that have electronic portfolio programs or are starting them is to think as much as possible about how to engage multiple stakeholders. To think, as Trent Batson will say in a column tomorrow in campus technology, how important it is to engage student affairs, people in developing portfolios, and other kinds of stakeholders, service learning, internship, career center, et cetera, as well as faculty, and to be able to link portfolios to courses. And I think really in sum, to me, the key question about how to go forward is in part to think about, what are the conversations that are going on your campus that are currently siloed and separate that at some level make sense to be siloed in a course-driven era, but thinking beyond courses don't make sense to be kept separate or siloed, and how can you connect them? So I wrap up, zoom out with the slide 33, which is just a quotation by Tim Castell. He says, the lesson to take from the current states of both the music industry and journalism is you have to have a clear understanding of how you're creating value so you build and protect the correct parts of your business model. Perhaps universities can learn this lesson before educational models are disrupted as well. And I don't make this analogy in any way reductively to universities as merely a business model, but really to suggest, how do we think about the future in terms of where we add value? And if we look around at the data, whether it's from students or from other sources of data, we already have some pretty strong evidence of where we're adding value. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question to sort of kick things off, but actually first, operator, can you tell people again how they can pose questions?
Thank you. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone.
Or alternatively, you could email them to me at info@insidehighered.com. Randy, I'd like to ask the first question, and I was very struck by what you said at the end about how this relates to faculty workload and particularly to colleges which rely on contingent faculty who aren't paid necessarily for their out-of-class time. Right now, we're seeing a lot of colleges and universities with the budget crisis adding to faculty workload. Do you see a model where a typical workload is not described in number of courses, but is described in, courses and other activities? How might that look?
Well, I think it's a really broad the discussion could go in different directions depending on the nature of the campus, but I think that every campus needs to have a conversation, almost a kind of audit of what are all the activities that we could bring under the notion of teaching and instruction, and who's doing them, and if we imagined scaling up certain activities, what is it that would need to be done for those things to continue? Even on campuses where scholarship of discovery is not weighted as much as teaching, I think that we can look to kind of national standards around scholarship as a kind of benchmark for nuance, in the sense that we have a very strong sense of the difference between what it means to publish a book versus an article versus a book review versus a conference versus organizing something for your professional society, et cetera. I mean, there's a whole range of subtle distinctions of kinds of activity that are made around scholarship. And yet we have the bluntest of analytics when it comes to teaching. Two courses, three courses, four courses, five courses, that's pretty much it. And you get a course off, et cetera. And, of course, there's some other things, especially on union campuses. But I don't know that most campuses have really sat down and had a conversation that just tried to analyze and audit what are all the things that are engaged in making certain kinds of learning experiences happen. And I think that conversation needs to be very broad, not just focused on what's all the extra stuff around courses or writing letters of recommendation, but really trying to be analytical about, you know, what are all the different acts that we consider parts of teaching or mentoring and in these high-impact experiences compared to courses. So, you know, I have no panacea and simple solutions for how that links with the way that we reward contingent faculty, but it seems to me that even campuses with large numbers of contingent faculty, one of the things that I see this even on our own campus that makes it difficult to have a conversation about a different way to recognize load and reward contingent faculty or regular faculty or to structure full-time appointments versus part-time appointments is that we just don't have a very subtle language for even talking about the different ways that a person engages in teaching, because our definition of teaching is so bound up in the bounded course. So I think that the lever there is at least to have a relatively analytic conversation that's broad around student learning, not first focused merely on faculty work.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. Our first question is from the line of AASCU. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is John Hamming. One of the problems, it seems to me, in terms of thinking about faculty work or getting beyond courses, is that for practical purposes, an undergraduate education is thought of as a collection of courses that add up to 120 hours that then are awarded a degree. But we don't have any common understanding, even within an individual campus, about what an undergraduate experience and an undergraduate education is supposed to be. Isn't that really the foundation question that we need to answer before answering some of the other practical hands-on questions?
I think it's certainly a huge part of it, and as I you know, I think if you're thinking about assessment and rethinking how you do assessment, the major shift of a course era to a post-course era is that we have to shift our attention from inputs to outputs, to put it clinically, crudely. That, you know, really the way we build the curriculum now is we have faith in inputs, that you take a certain number of courses, we believe in some minimal kind of gatekeeping around those courses, and if you pass them, you're educated. But that is already shifting, and it's not as if we have to entirely invent that, in that, for example, the e-portfolio movement is significantly shifting to at least asking questions about what does it look like to look at learning that aggregates over a series of these. And some places are, you know, are making portfolio reads gatekeeping. Others, they're just very generative ways to get students to be retained and connected to the institution. But increasingly, I think as that conversation goes forward, we're going to get better at thinking about outputs and how we measure learning on the expressive end. And at some level, obviously not entirely, we have to tie what we think of as a course or a creditable experience as being linked to our ability to judge output effectively. You know, and I think that'll unfold over time, but I think a lot of the pieces are starting to build. Many of them are unconnected at the moment, and some of them rely too heavily on summative assessment and work products as opposed to thinking about being able to make judgments about people's development mid-course. But in any case, I agree with you. I think that shift from inputs to outputs, being able to read the evidence of experience and learning is a really key part of the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, could we have our next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. Our next question is from Truman State University. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question that goes a little more directly to the theory behind this presentation. How do we explain that many students, and I dare say many faculty, also look back on their lecture courses where they sat passively as transformative experiences, that is, places where real deep thinking did take place? Most of us can I think, identify with that initial quote that we had from the student that said, oh, it was just a gen ed course. But then there are other students who really do get a lot out of a lecture, and I think a lot of faculty also.
I guess I haven't seen the data that shows that is enough the case to justify that particular pedagogy as a dominant paradigm. I don't think there's any question. I completely agree with the premise of your question that you can have an effective experience in a lecture. I think you have to be engaged at some level. I think there's certain kinds of students, the students who later realize that a passive lecture course was transformative are often students who are already engaged at some level, many of whom grew up to be professors. I agree that it happens sometimes, but I don't believe, and I'd have to see the data, that it happens frequently enough that we should build our curriculum around it, especially given that we have a growing body of data to the contrary.
Yeah, and
thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, do you want to ask a follow-up question?
If I could, please, yes. I think anecdotally, without taking anything away from the value of the experiential learning, there's no doubt about that, that is something that we all need to strive for and to increase in our curricula. But it seems to me that most of us often see students making huge gains that have already been out in the world. And so they have something that they can connect the learning to.
Yes, and I think that, you know, when you think about, you know, sort of the three things that I was suggesting, you know, making courses higher impact and connecting courses better to experience, it seems to me those first two are in some ways the most powerful directions we should be following. That experience that remains sort of unreflected upon and different kind, you know, as Dewey would say, although we can, you know, we have faith that experience can be highly educational, not every experience is educational, not every experience is you know, edifying. So really I think part of what we need to think of to add value is how is it that we can reintegrate what it is we're really good at, faculty and universities and colleges, with what we see can be very effective in informal experiential environments. It seems to me that the product we're striving for is a synthesis of those two that's all too rare, neither purely academic nor purely experiential.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. Our next question is from Palo Alto College. Go ahead, please.
Hello, this is Beth Tanner, and my question is, I appreciate the everyone's willingness to adhere to something other than faith in what's going on. In other words, I'm perfectly willing to leave my faith and inputs and reconsider my faith and outputs. But my question is, how is it that we can adopt this change in our point of view, the extracurricular and the formal curricular events, if we don't have the assessment tools, and we admit that we don't have the assessment tools that really evaluate the effect of what we're doing? I mean, faith-based is faith-based no matter where you place your faith. So how do we go beyond having faith and only faith in what we do?
Well, this is, of course, an ironic question to be asking someone from a Catholic institution. But I think that there are two ways to approach that answer that I would say, and one is to find the really meaningful, small, local connections where we can learn something from them in meaningful ways. That is, not try to imagine remaking the whole curriculum, but imagining where are the touch points where there's actually almost this connection being made, but we just don't have the right group of people focusing on it. And then it seems to me the corollary to that is what is the most kind of minimal but meaningful structure we could put around bringing the right people around the table to look at certain kinds of work products that would tell us something about the efficacy of certain kinds of projects. I think some of the schools that have built faculty learning communities around reading portfolios have already begun a really fascinating journey in having conversations about outcomes. I think the more that those conversations are not just faculty reading portfolios, but inclusive, say, of certain kinds of student affairs people, those can be even richer. So I think we need to basically invent our assessment expertise as a matter of inquiry and unfolding research with a small r that folds into our kind of everyday practice. But institutions, whether it's centers for teaching or drives around accreditation, need to think about what are some of the kind of minimal structures that can be put around those kinds of things. Let me just mention really briefly two examples of kind of integrative moments that to me are examples that they don't have to be large-scale revolutions, though we all like to dream in those. One is something that we've done here that was part of the national project on bringing theory to practice, which some of your schools may be involved in, which was trying to look at the relationship between engaged learning and stress and depression and substance abuse. And we've created something we call the Engelhard Project that works on something called curriculum infusion, where student affairs and student health people work with faculty to create just one class or 1 week units where the faculty member finds an appropriate place in the semester that links with organically with the intellectual material of the course to introduce mental health and wellness issues. And there's a kind of combination of students do a reflection, a reading, it links to the material, someone from student health or student affairs, psych center comes in, talks. It's a way of lifting a veil of shame off of feeling stressed, the near crisis, off of the few students who are who are teetering on the edge. But it brings everybody into a much more engaged connection where there's a place in the course where there's a structure for people to engage personal with intellectual material. So it's very focused around mental health and wellness, but it's been extraordinarily successful on our campus. We now are at a place where we reach virtually every incoming student with one of these modules by the end of their sophomore year. We could never have done it if we hadn't had a kind of unprecedented collaboration between faculty development people, student affairs, and student health people. I've been on campus 19 years, and there were people over in student health who'd been here just as long I never met until we started working on this project. A second quick example is from University of Kansas, where they have a wonderful project on universal course design, which they've taken the analogy from universal design of buildings, where you bring together your disability and access people and all your other constructors, contractors, et cetera, to design a building from the ground up for everybody's needs. They've taken that analogy to what does it look like to rebuild certain gen ed courses in a universal context. And some of this has to do with what we traditionally think of as accessibility, but it also includes what would it look like to rebuild a course with a librarian at the table, with the writing center person at the table, with someone from the academic resources at the table. What does it look like if you then imagine the faculty member as part of a team of people designing a course for universal access? Well, you could easily imagine taking some of the things that I've been talking about and including other people in that and starting to say, what would it look like to redesign a course where the boundaries are even more porous? And then you focus your assessment energies around the outcomes of that course, and you start learning about how to read outputs versus inputs based on something that you've redesigned as a collective whole. So that's at the University of Kansas. So those are just two examples that don't seem like revolutionary, but they involve these really kind of sweet spots of cross-boundary collaboration that really help change the terrain.
I want to get in one more question. This is one by email. What role can and will accrediting organizations play in the post-course era?
Well, I think that it's very, important that they continue to be flexible around, how it is that they count courses and credits and units. And if schools want to become more experimental with the ways that you're wrapping, say, for example, certain kinds of credit-bearing experiences around hybrid academic experiential sorts of learning, that we can work with accreditation organizations to try to understand how that stays within their boundaries. So I think that's really the primary kind of thing that nobody would be stymied in trying to get creative, simply because there's an overly rigid notion of what credit looks like or what a course looks like. So I think trying to engage accreditation is important.
Well, thank you. That's all the time we have for our Q&A today. I want to thank our listeners for some excellent questions and ideas, and thank you, Randy, for sharing your expertise. We'll be sending around an evaluation form to all listeners about this session and to suggest topics for future sessions. For today, thank you very much, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. That concludes the conference. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.